Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Audio bandwidth for Security Now is provided by Winamp for Android, the ultimate media player for your desktop and Android device, featuring wireless sync. Download it free at winamp.com/android. Video bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. You'll find all the TWiT shows on your Roku box, Android, and BlackBerry phones, and all Yahoo Widget TVs powered by MediaFly. For more information, visit twit.tv/MediaFly. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 277, recorded December 1st, 2010. Your questions, Steve's answers, number 106. Security Now is brought to you by Ford and voice-activated sync, featuring true hands-free calling, turn-by-turn directions, 911 assist, and more. Available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. And by the Eco-Imagination Challenge from General Electric. GE and its partners are awarding $200 million to ideas that help build the next generation power grid for the 21st century. For more information and to view and comment on ideas, go to ecoimagination.com/challenge. And by GoToAssist Express. If you're in tech support, clients rely on you for fast and reliable service. Help them the fast and easy way with GoToAssist Express. For a free 30-day trial, visit GoToAssist.com/security. It's time for Security Now, the show that protects you and your loved ones on the interwebs. Here he is, the star of Security Now, the man, the myth, the legend. I love saying that.
Now I'm making you self-conscious about the myth part.
Steve Gibson.
Yes.
There are myths about you.
We'll do a little mythology over the Christmas break. We'll have a mythological episode.
Yeah, we should tell everybody that. For the first time ever, I've convinced Steve to take a week off. First, it'll be you don't have to if you really don't want to, but everybody else is going to be gone the week after Christmas. But we can get somebody
hello,
in here.
Hello.
We'll just turn on a camera and let you do the show. But since you have this great episode that's so appropriate, I think it's going to end up being kind of our Christmas goose, you know?
That makes sense. Because, I mean, and there is some churn in our listeners. So there are certainly people hearing this podcast that are going, the portable dog killer? What the hell are they talking about?
Although the notion of a rerun in podcasts is a trifle ridiculous.
Leo, you are a pioneer. If anything can be said of you, it's that you are a pioneer.
I am a pioneer.
Pioneered the podcast rerun.
Yes, my wagon wheel hath broken. Let us what are we doing today? We're doing a Q&A, are we not?
We have a Q&A. This is a broad spectrum Q&A. I remember saying yesterday, or it just feels like yesterday, last week, that I imagined that our Q&A would be focusing on DNS. I don't think one of them was about DNS.
Oh, isn't that funny?
You know, because we had done the prior two podcasts about first the GRC DNS benchmark and then the spoofability test. And I thought, we'll do a bunch of Q&A about that. But I found so many interesting questions and so much to talk about this week that I didn't get around to that. So no DNS. Actually, there was one question, but it's only tangentially related to DNS. It's more about the nightmare of routing on the internet. So, I got a ton of people, listeners, and twits and tweets and everything happened because there was a report about vitamin D that was on the front page of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, NPR covered it, local radio. People at Starbucks this morning were asking me. And so I wanted to talk about that a little bit because it was a very bad, bad report that came out. And we've got some news, and a number of people have asked for a sci-fi update, like what I've been reading lately. So I thought I'd
update that.
Update on people on that. So we got tons of fun stuff to talk about. I think a great podcast for everybody.
And just a word of warning, I just saw Twitter that Denise Howell, who hosts our This Week in Law program, is listening. She says, I must be the first Security Now listener to ever listen in a kindergarten classroom. I don't think that's true, but I'm glad you're listening, Denise. let us take a break before we get to the meat of the matter, because I want to mention our friends at Ford. You know, I have to say, this show, we've got advertisements from Ford, General Electric, and Citrix, the three mighty industrial giants that have made this great nation. Well, at least Ford and General Electric. Citrix is pretty good in my book, too.
They're on the way.
They're on the way. But it's kind of neat because, you know, when we first started podcasting, I thought, especially a show like this, well, we'll only get the geekiest of advertisers. And it's kind of a vote of confidence from two of the biggest companies in not just the U.S., but the world that they support podcasting. And I think that's fantastic. Ford is somebody I have. It's a little kind of near and dear to my heart since I, in fact, drive a Ford, my lovely Ford Mustang that I kind of have a deep man crush on. One of the things that I like so much about the Ford and all the new Fords is the Ford Sync. In fact, my wife now is ready to dump the Toyota for a... she's either wants a Flex or an Edge. We're going back and forth on that. And I think the Sync is a lot of it. You know, Jennifer is not the most technical of people. I don't think I'm saying anything she would find offensive to say that. And she's never been able to figure out how any of the GPS electronics, stereo, anything work on her car. And, you know, when I play with it, coming from the Ford Sync, I go, you know, you're right, Jennifer, this is terrible. The Sync is so, you just know it's well designed. It's just easy to use. It just makes sense. What is Sync? Well, it's the you know, true hands-free calling. The idea is you keep your eye on the road and your hands on the wheel as you motor down the highway of life, but you still get to do all the things you want to do. Listen to podcasts or music, get turn-by-turn directions. You can even control things like the temperature in the car via your voice. Climate control, 74 degrees, and it sets it. Things like that. It's exclusively available on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles, and it is, bar none, I've tried them all, the best hands-free system I've ever used. I mean, it reads my text messages from my Android phone and my Windows phone. It reads me my text messages. And it even has canned responses I can send back. It keeps you connected to your life while you are paying attention to the road, which, of course, we absolutely have to do. You know, there's some safety features, too, like the 911 assist that deploys. If your airbags deploy, it calls 911, gives them your GPS from the GPS in the car, so it's very accurate. They know exactly where you are, which is a problem with 911 on the road if you're just using your cell phone. And then it plays a recorded message and gives you a chance to talk. It's just incredible. I want you to try it. The easiest way to do it is to go to your local Ford, Lincoln, or Mercury dealer and take a test drive. And speaking of test drives, we've got a little action going on. It's the 2010 Ford Focus Global, actually 2012 Ford Focus Global test drive. 2012, I know it seems like, wait a minute, I don't want to win a prize 2 years from now. Well, the 2012 Focus comes out early 2011, early next year. And you could be one of the first people to drive this great car. They're having a little contest. And not only would you be one of the first people to drive it, you'd go to Spain to do so. Yes, it's a trip for you and a friend to Spain's National Institute for Aerospace Technology, where you will get to drive the 2012 Ford Focus, the five-door hatchback, the four-door sedan, or the five-door wagon. I've seen it. I haven't driven it. It's just a gorgeous car. And loaded with the best tech. Of course, it's the Ford Sync. In fact, it's my Ford Touch, which is Sync Plus, including an 8-inch screen in the center console, two screens behind the steering wheel, the latest parking technologies, including Active Park Assist, which I love in the Flex, the rear view camera, the torque vectoring control hugs the curves, the incredible fuel-efficient engines that Ford has made absolutely famous. To get a sneak peek at the all-new 2012 Ford Focus, submit a video now at twitfordfocus.com. That'll actually take you to a Facebook page where you can read all about the Ford Focus and submit that video. Now, by the way, not only do you get a trip to Madrid if you win, you also get $10,000 for the charitable cause of your choice. Ford will donate a total of $500,000 in all. You need to submit a video. It explains here that is no longer than 2 minutes, why you want to be one of the first to test drive the 2012 Ford Focus, and how you'd start something more for a good cause with the local market equivalent of $10,000. Why do I say local market equivalent? Because I am so proud of Ford. This is open to our audience members worldwide. I'm happy to say everywhere in the world you can participate. Go to twitfordfocus.com, read the instructions, make a video, and good luck. And we'll see you in Madrid. I'm lobbying to get on that trip. I want to go. Thanks to Ford for their support of this show and podcasts all over. They really get it. So, Steve, let's start with our security updates. Are there any?
Well, we don't actually have any security updates this week. We had another slow week. However, I did note that Adobe has updated their version 10 of Flash, not patching security problems, but reportedly working to essentially lower its power consumption.
Huh.
It's interesting. So they're at 10.2 now. And it was maybe like last week I was at a Starbucks operating on batteries, I think with a PC, and I don't remember now what it was. Something flash was going on, and I have my battery meter set so that it's showing me how much remaining time it estimates I have. And that's something where it's looking at the history of the battery use. It's dynamically measuring the current that the whole system is pulling from the battery and extrapolating based on the current draw. How, if things stayed the way they are now, how long would that last? Sort of the same way Spinrite estimates how long it's going to take to get done, which, you know, it's the best you can do, even though it can be fooled. So, for example, if I turn the screen brightness way up and I wait a few seconds, I'll see that it's like, oh, that seems to be big. You know, it's like drawing a lot of power, and suddenly my battery is projected to last a lot less long, as opposed to turning the screen brightness down. Well, what I noticed was when Flash was doing whatever it was doing, I don't think I was watching a video. I think it was some other application was, you know, jumping around. It seriously dropped the performance of the battery life of my system.
Oh,
so
you
this
bet.
You know, this is what we've heard, is what Jobs was complaining about. His justification for not putting Flash on the iPad was that it was just a hog in terms of performance. And I mean, the fact that just video movement is drawing so much power tells me as an engineer the degree to which there has been a huge effort already in minimizing power consumption. That is, if, you know, changing stuff on the screen makes that big a difference as opposed to having your screen static. In fact, I then played around with just like scrolling, and sure enough, just if I was scrolling all the time, I could see an impact on my battery life compared to not. So our systems have become so sensitive to anything going on in order to get the battery life that we want and that they claim that, you know, it's in fact, that's one of the reasons that when people were benchmarking the iPad after its release, you know, the iPad was claimed to have a battery life of 12 plus hours. People played videos on them for that long to see if you kept it alive and kept it busy, how long the battery lasted. So anyway, it's good news that Adobe is sensitive to this. We know our listeners may remember that with version 10, they were beginning to not do all of their video rendering in software, but they were going to be tied more directly to the hardware, which of course makes it bigger still. But given that you've got some hardware that Flash could sink its teeth into and hook into, the potential is that you would be able to see less power consumption hit with Flash doing what it's doing. So, you know, it's a good thing that they're moving forward. I think I might still be on 9 and have it moved to 10. So it's probably worth doing that and see if I see an improvement. So that's changed. We do have some news. Not surprisingly, Windows is in trouble once again. Just a few days ago, news came out of a privilege escalation zero-day vulnerability, meaning that malware was found in the wild that was using a hitherto.
I don't know if unhitherto is a word, but hitherto is a word.
A hitherto.
A not hitherto.
Not previously known. but henceforth known.
There you go. I'm sure Denise Howell would know how to say that.
Notwithstanding, I didn't quite get my hands around that one. But anyway, problem with the kernel in both 32 and 64-bit XP Vista Win 7 and Win 2008 Service Pack 2, which allows software which has already made it onto your machine, allows software to increase its privilege. So a privilege escalation vulnerability. There's a stack overflow error that was found in the NTGDI enable EUDC function, which allows an attacker who calls that function to inject their return address as a return address into their own code, so that when that function, which is a privileged function, returns, it returns to their code, maintaining full system privileges. And this is significant because proof of concept code is in the wild, and it then would allow full system privileges to be obtained by code which would normally be running with restricted privileges, which much more code does these days, for example, especially under Vista in Win 7. And this is like exactly what code wants in order to install rootkits, because it is by running with limited privileges that the kinds of things you want to do, like writing to sector zero of the hard drive or installing hooks into the operating system, those things you cannot do under limited privileges, but you have much more ability to do that if you've got system privileges. So the bad news is that we're recording this on December 1st, which is Wednesday, meaning that we missed by one day. Ooh. Having Tuesday be the first day of the month, which would have meant that the second Tuesday of the month, if yesterday were December 1st, would have been the earliest possible second Tuesday. Instead, it's the worst possible second Tuesday, meaning that the second Tuesday doesn't occur until December 14th, which is as late as it's ever possible to have it occur, which is this month. Meaning that even if Microsoft, of course, they could, go crazy and respond to this in an out-of-band patch, but I don't think they're going to.
Well, it also takes a while to do a patch. I mean, you can't just whip it out.
True, because, it's all of their operating system platforms. It's both the 32 and 64-bit versions. They want to make sure they don't break something else when they fix this. I mean, a stack overflow mistake on a parameter of a function call like this, that's just about as easy to fix as anything I could imagine. I mean, there's going to be one compare instruction which is, responsible, which is missing, which they need to stick in to prevent this. So this is about as simple and clean a fix as I can imagine. I just don't think they're going to see that this is crucial unless something horrible happens between now and 2 weeks from yesterday, which would, really make them jump faster. But so I expect to see this thing fixed in 2 weeks, probably not before. There's nothing really actionable that our listeners can do. There's no workarounds, there's no patches or anything. It's not crucial, but it has happened. So I wanted people to know. And, as a little bit of additional explanation of why these things are bad, this is exactly what rootkit installers live for, mm-hmm. is this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And just in other news, relative to topics we've covered several times, you may have seen that Ahmadinejad has acknowledged publicly that the Stuxnet worm did in fact infiltrate the nuclear fuel enrichment processes in Iran and took some of their centrifuges offline. He, of course, downplayed the significance and vulnerability, and you know, it'll never happen again, he said. And well, you know, that one probably won't, but you know, it's very hard, as we know, to keep these things from creeping around in people's computer systems. But you know, so the essentially the very early on, before there was much evidence, people were suggesting that this was the case. I didn't talk about it then because there just didn't seem to be nearly enough evidence to make that claim, though it was certainly feasible. Then, thanks to Symantec's great reverse engineering, they demonstrated convincingly, which is when I finally said, okay, this really does look like there's enough to believe it. They convincingly demonstrated how narrowly targeted and focused the actual exploit end of this worm was. And then a week later, it was acknowledged that, yes, in fact, it had been effective to some degree in slowing them down. So for those people who've been worried about Iran's nuclear enrichment, I guess, you know, the problem is millions of systems got infected with Stuxnet in order to just target one, essentially.
Oh, you think all of the Stuxnet worms were from the same source?
Yeah.
Probably, let's face it, Israel.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
It's funny I was at dinner last night with smart but not particularly technical people, and that was a topic of conversation. It was so interesting to hear people talking about Stuxnet, you know, whether Israel had anything to do with it, what its impact was. I thought, wow, this has gotten mainstream.
And in fact, I don't know what it was. It was on one of the programs I watch, you know, regular broadcast TV. They were like saying Stuxnet, like they hadn't, you know, they were trying to pronounce it correctly. And it's like, wow, this, as you say, Leo, really has gone mainstream. So
very interesting,
but, you know, for good reasons. Yep. Speaking of mainstream, also in the news was WikiLeaks. And this massive leak of more than 250,000 previously secret cables between countries. And I thought my angle on it was to see what I could find and share about the SIPRNET, SIPRNET, which is the acronym for Secret IP Routed Network, which is the government's global non-internet, essentially. That is, it uses IP protocols. It has TCP/IP. It uses existing router technology, but it's a network that exists physically disconnected from the regular internet. And unfortunately, one of the consequences of the U.S.'s post 9/11 attempt to get agencies to communicate much better, the term was used, stovepiping was the term that we heard in Congress, where, you know, the idea being that individual stovepipes were the sort of, if you can imagine it visually, dropped around different departments that were containing their information and not communicating. Well, this is a classic example of, you know, what happens when you do create much greater degrees of communication. You know, apparently they believed that it was some private first class in Baghdad, a security analyst, a junior security analyst, who, as a consequence of this much enhanced interdepartmental communication, had on his own machine access to all this, and he had, you know, some gripes against things that he saw going on, and so took it upon himself to send all this stuff off to WikiLeaks. What's interesting is that there was some immediate reaction saying, oh, well, we're going to disable writing to removable thumb drives on these SIPRNET equipped high security systems. And it's like, oh, you're going to do that now?
Surprising that they didn't do it before.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, you know, and on all removable devices. It's like, well, why do these computers have removable devices?
Yeah.
You know, it's just nutty that It's like, oh, well, oh, and then they're going to require that two people be present in order to transfer any information from a classified machine to a non-classified machine. And, you know, so now they're going to take a bunch of measures to deal with really what should have been done before. But, you know, that's the nature of the government's involvement with technology, yeah, largely, is it just sort of doesn't get it right the first time. Yeah. So, you know, this was certainly a huge diplomatic catastrophe. You know, people are saying that not that much was learned that wasn't known before. Certainly some embarrassment and problems. And it does hurt the U.S. From a diplomatic standpoint. So not a good thing. And we'll talk about this a little bit later on relative to some concerns about the U.S.'s clamping down on domains they don't like because, you know.
Yeah, that bothers me, this ICE thing,
Yes, it does bother me. And you can imagine that they could say, oh, well, we don't want WikiLeaks to be available either because we think they're bad. Right. And so that suddenly disappears from the earth, which yeah, I agree with you, Leo. It's really a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
In errata, I noted that the Supreme Court had declined to hear the Whitney Harper case, which I was distraught about, but not surprised, unfortunately. The Whitney Harper case is a 10-year-old RIAA, MPAA lawsuit against a girl who at the time was 12 years old when she was using...
Oh, please.
Yeah. When she was using Kazaa to download music and share it with friends, which she didn't understand, which she could not do 10 years ago. She thought it was like internet radio. And there's under the law, there's something known as the inadvertent innocent infringer, which carries a fine of $200 maximum, as opposed to the non-innocent infringer, which carries a fine, which is what the RIAA is seeking, of $150,000 per song. So they're saying that she and her family are liable for $150,000 per song for, I think it was 40-some songs that they identified at the time, making this a huge problem. Now, the first trial judge agreed with her defense attorneys, saying that she was innocent, first of all, because she really didn't understand this was illegal, and no copyright notice of any kind was present in or on what she downloaded. So here she was saying, you know, and her defense attorneys were saying, wait a minute, you know,
how was she supposed to know?
Exactly. The RIAA is saying that these are copyrighted, but you know, in the beginning of the songs didn't state that, and it didn't say so anywhere during her experience. So this went to appeal, and the federal appeals court judges concluded that a copyright notice anywhere trumps the innocent infringer defense.
Oh, meaning, my goodness.
I know. The RIAA was saying that the labels on the original CD cases, which had to have been opened in order to take the CD out of the case to upload it to the internet where she found it, those cases contained a copyright notice, and that's enough.
Well, I can understand that. I mean, if they're being pirated, the pirate's not going to reproduce a copyright notice in any event.
Right. But now, this is
a 12-year-old girl. I mean, if this is not the definition of an innocent offender, I don't know what is.
And so the problem was that the federal appeals court judges agreed with the RIAA's plaintiff attorneys that she was guilty under the non-innocent infringer case and could be fined as much as $150,000 per song. So everyone was holding their breath. hoping that now that this had gone, you know, to the appellate court, that this would be heard by the Supreme Court, and they declined.
I can understand that. I mean, you don't want to set a precedent that if a pirate strips out the copyright, then you're innocent. You don't know anything about it, and because you could strip a copyright out of everything, and certainly music. We don't want it to say at the beginning of every song, copyright 2010 by Madonna, all rights reserved, at the beginning of every song. So I can understand that.
And of course, if they did that, then the people uploading it would just trim that off the front. I mean,
exactly.
You know,
exactly.
This is out of control, unfortunately. And
you got to wonder, though, if you're a recording artist, how you feel about the fact that your label,
yes,
is going after a 12-year-old girl asking for $155,000 fine for the download of your song.
Her song.
Yeah. Yep. How would you feel? How do you feel, artists? Why do you put up with this? Why do you allow this? Because to me, all it would do is encourage, frankly, people to steal.
Yeah.
I don't think this is a good way to win goodwill in any way.
Over the holidays, the first holiday, Thanksgiving, I encountered the notice on Wikipedia about donations.
Yes. And you couldn't miss it.
you could not miss it. It was very much in your face. And I gave the guy $100.
Me too. That's funny. That's exactly what I gave him too. Yeah. I've done that before too.
Yeah. And, you know, and I, so I just wanted to make a mention of the fact that, you know, I mean, you know, you and I can afford $100. I don't expect all of our listeners to do that.
No, but a dollar's fine. Anything.
Yes. But only if you use Wikipedia. My point was that I encountered it because I use Wikipedia. I mean, I don't know if there's a day, frankly, now.
Exactly.
That goes by. It's the first link that you see in Google when you put anything in virtually. And I find it highly useful. And I know there are skeptics who say, oh, well, you know, anybody can go in there and modify. It's like, whoa, wait a minute. I mean, you know, yes, there's a bunch of nonsense on the internet. There's also a bunch of, you know, high quality material. And I would say, you know, it's free, but it sure beats anything else that I know of, as if nothing else, as a starting point for research. And it contains so much valuable information that I'm thinking that maybe the way I will spend my retirement is in dumping, you know, everything I've learned in my life of technical and useful nature into Wikipedia.
That would be an even bigger contribution than $100. That would be of great value.
But still, I just wanted to mention to our listeners,
I agree.
You know, hey, you know, if you find yourself using it, if you rely on it, if you value it, give it a few bucks, because I mean, we don't want it to have to become advertising supported.
No, and that's one of the neat things. I mean, Jimmy Wales has said, I've been told, he says, we could make hundreds of millions of dollars a year by putting ads on Wikipedia. We don't want to, but in order to avoid that, we need to ask for support because these servers aren't free. And I think it's one of the great resources of the 21st century. Absolutely, everybody who uses it should contribute a little bit, if you know, as much as you can.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%.
So yesterday, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I got flooded. Actually, I encountered it in the morning on the front page of the New York Times, and I thought, oh, goodness. I mean, the headline was essentially, I don't have it in front of me, but it was no need to supplement with extra vitamin D and calcium.
Really?
Yes.
Huh.
And New York Times, Wall Street Journal, NPR, I was on ABC Good Morning something or other. I got email from friends. You can imagine, my Twitter feed went nuts with our listeners. And then a ton of email, which I knew was going to happen. I wanted to share with our listeners the reaction that I knew would be coming from the founder of the Vitamin D Council, John Cannell, who's an MD, whose video I have on the Vitamin D page. Because he nicely summarizes this. I'll say, first of all, that this was a sort of a quasi-governmental, in fact, that's his term, agency, the Food and Nutrition Board, and they only addressed the bone strength aspects of vitamin D. So to the degree that they addressed this, they were correct. I noted that 2 weeks ago, there was a news blurb where it was found that 1 in 5 children in the world had symptoms of rickets. So it's certainly not the case that everybody is getting even that incredibly low level minimum amount of vitamin D required to prevent that. But this spring, as I've mentioned before, I received an awful lot of email feedback from our listeners saying that last winter, because I talked about vitamin D last August, and many people started supplementing, they were reporting in the winter that it was the first, or in the spring following the winter, it was the first time they'd cruised through the holiday season without catching cold and the flu. Mark Thompson,
me too.
Mark Thompson, my good buddy in who does the Analog X website, who's in Phoenix of all places. Well, he actually does live like a bat. I visited his home the other day for the first time, and he has box shutters, all which are closed, so no light comes in the house at all. He is actually running wacky programmer hours at the moment. He gets up in the middle of the afternoon and he works all night long. So and sleeps during the day, so he has to do that, you know, in order to get some sleep. But he was, a couple years ago, he was sick every single time I talked to him on the phone. He'd be coughing and sneezing and wheezing. I mean, so that I was really actively getting concerned about him. It's like, Mark, you know, you're sick all the time, every time I talk to you. And he's like, oh, yeah, well, I just got back from a trip somewhere and, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, he started taking vitamin D after I learned about it last summer. He hasn't been sick once since. I mean, it completely changed his life. And of course, we know that that's immune system boosting. But remember that, and so not getting colds and flu is the short-term consequence. But the long-term consequence is not getting cancer.
Yeah.
Because it's our immune system that is protecting us all the time from little cancers that are trying to start and are getting zapped before they ever have a chance to get going. So anyway, this, and I'm not going to do a Spinrite testimonial because I want to read this instead. John writes, after 13 years of silence, the quasi-governmental agency, the Institute of Medicine's Food and Nutrition Board, today recommended that a 3-pound premature infant take virtually the same amount of vitamin D as a 300-pound pregnant woman. While that 400 IU per day dose is close to adequate for infants, 600 IU per day in pregnant women will do nothing to help the three childhood epidemics most closely associated with gestational and early childhood vitamin D deficiencies: asthma, autoimmune disorders, and as recently reported in the largest pediatric journal in the world, autism. Professor Bruce Hollis of the Medical University of South Carolina has shown pregnant and lactating women need at least 5,000 IU per day, not 600. The FMB also reported that vitamin D toxicity might occur at an intake of 10,000 IU per day, which is 250 micrograms per day, although they could produce no reproducible evidence that 10,000 IU per day has ever caused toxicity in humans, and only one poorly conducted study indicating that 20,000 IU per day may cause mild elevations in serum calcium, but not clinical toxicity. Viewed with different measure, this FNB report recommends that an infant should take 10 micrograms per day, that is to say 400 IU, and a pregnant woman 15 micrograms per day, or 600 IU, as a single 30-minute dose of summer sunshine gives adults more than 10,000 IU, the FNB is apparently also warning that natural vitamin D input, as occurred from the sun before the widespread use of sunscreen is dangerous. That is, the FNB is implying that God knows that God does not know what she's doing.
I like that.
Disturbingly, this FNB committee focused on bone health, just like they did 14 years ago. They ignored the thousands of studies from the last 10 years that showed higher doses of vitamin D helps heart health, brain health, breast health, prostate health, pancreatic health, muscle health, nerve health, eye health, immune health, colon health, liver health, mood health, skin health, and especially fetal health.
And health health.
And health health. Tens of millions of pregnant women and their breastfeeding infants are severely vitamin D deficient, resulting in a great increase in the medieval disease rickets. Mm-hmm. The FNB report seems to reason that if so many pregnant women have low vitamin D blood levels, then it must be okay because such low levels are so common. However, such circular logic simply represents the caveman existence, parens never exposed to the light of the sun, of most modern-day pregnant women, which, of course, is what has happened, is right. We've all gone indoors and
sun's bad for you, don't you know?
And when we're outdoors, we're wearing clothes right. And or sunscreen.
Yeah.
He says, hence, if you want to optimize your vitamin D levels, not just optimize the bone effect, supplementation is crucial, but it is almost impossible to significantly raise your vitamin D levels when supplementing at only 600 IU per day. Pregnant women taking 400 IU per day have the same blood levels as a pregnant woman not taking vitamin D. That is, 400 IU is a meaninglessly small dose for pregnant women. Even taking 2,000 IU per day of vitamin D only increases the vitamin D levels of most pregnant women by about 10 points, depending mainly on their weight. Professor Bruce Hollis has shown that 2,000 IU per day does not raise vitamin D to healthy or natural levels in either pregnant or lactating women. Therefore, supplementing with higher amounts, like 5,000 IU per day, is crucial for those women who want their fetus to enjoy optimal vitamin D levels and the future health benefits that go along with it. For example, taking only two of the hundreds of recently published studies, Professor Urashima and colleagues in Japan gave 1,200 IU per day of vitamin D3 for 6 months to Japanese 10-year-olds in a randomized controlled trial. They found vitamin D dramatically reduced the incidence of influenza A, as well as the episodes of asthma attacks in the treated kids, while the placebo group was not so fortunate. Dr. Urashima had followed Dr. Urashima had followed the newest FNB recommendations, it is unlikely that the 400 IU per day treatment would have done much of anything, and some of the treated youngsters may have come to serious harm without the vitamin D. Likewise, a randomized controlled prevention trial of adults by Professor Joan Lapp and colleagues at Creighton University, which showed dramatic improvements in the health of internal organs, used more than twice the FNB's new adult recommendations. Finally, the FNB committee consulted with 14 vitamin D experts. And after reading those 14 different reports, the FNB decided to suppress their reports. Many of these 14 consultants are either famous vitamin D researchers, like Professor Robert Heaney of Creighton, or, as in the case of Professor Walter Willett at Harvard, the single best-known nutritionist in the world. So the FNB will not tell us what Professors Heaney and Willett thought of their new report. Why not? Today, the Vitamin D Council directed our attorney to file a federal Freedom of Information request to the IOM's FNB for the release of these 14 reports. Most of my friends, hundreds of patients, and thousands of readers of the Vitamin D Council newsletter, not to mention myself, have been taking 5,000 IU per day for up to 8 years. Not only have they reported no significant side effects, indeed, they've reported greatly improved health in multiple organ systems. My advice, especially for pregnant women, continue taking 5,000 IU per day until your 25 OHD is between 50 and 80 nanograms per milliliter. The vitamin D blood levels obtained by humans who live and work in the sun and the midpoint of the current reference ranges at all American laboratories. Gestational vitamin D deficiency is not only associated with rickets, but a significantly increased risk of neonatal pneumonia, a doubled risk for preeclampsia, a tripled risk for gestational diabetes, and a quadrupled risk for primary cesarean section. Today, the FNB has failed millions of pregnant women whose yet unborn babies will pay the price. Let us hope the FNB will comply with the spirit of transparency by quickly responding to our freedom of information requests. And I should just mention that this story produced the story in the New York Times produced a phenomenal response in people posting to the story. When I looked in the morning, there were already 255 some responses, and many had been redacted by the people at the New York Times. Saying that they had protocols, they couldn't allow the level of fury that was being expressed. No doubt, expletives and obscenities. So they were deleting these things. But there were a number of very knowledgeable responses from people who were saying, "Okay, this is just really irresponsible to be in the news."
It's a little odd. You know, and I noticed that since you raised my awareness on this, that my own doctor has started testing for vitamin D when he does blood tests. It's just kind of part of the routine blood tests now. My wife got hers back, and she was low. And he recommended, or she recommended, a supplementation.
Yeah.
So.
Anyway, I know that it's been a big interest of our listeners ever since I did the podcast August before last, and I got this generated so much feedback that I wanted to cover it today and just say, they looked only at bone health. It is the case that much less D is necessary for bone health, much more necessary. Essentially, the level you would have if you were spending your days out in the sun and you were a young person near the equator, to keep you healthy. Right. So.
I'm taking my supplements. At least I know they're not harmful, but you should, obviously, folks, we're not doctors. You should consult your physician. And if you're worried, ask for a vitamin D test.
Yeah.
Before we get to science fiction.
Yes.
Do you want to do some science fiction?
I'll cover it quickly, and then we'll get into our Q&A.
We've got some great Q&A, too. Let me mention our friends at General Electric. The Eco Imagination Challenge is on from GE, and they're actually I love this. They're looking for great ideas to help build the next generation power grid for the 21st century. The Eco Imagination Challenge is online. You can either submit your idea or look at others' ideas and vote on them at ecomagination.com/challenge. ecomagination.com/challenge. There's a lot of really great stuff there. It's actually kind of fun to visit the Eco Imagination Challenge because people have great imaginations and great ideas, and it's going to take some, I think, to us, to dig us out of the problems that we have. We've been consuming resources kind of lickety split for some time. Now, making a smarter grid, making it more efficient, seems like a very good idea. $200 million for this, by the way. It's a new program from General Electric for entrepreneurs, businesses, innovators, and students. GE is going to invest $200 million in the greatest ideas, the best ideas. Actually, it looks like we've got some winners. I'm looking at the site. Go look at the winners. There are three categories that GE will be making investments in: renewables, grid efficiency, and eco homes and buildings. And you can watch these videos and learn more about the Eco Imagination Challenge at the website. Capstone Metering LLC, one of the winners, with Scott Williamson. Electric Route out of New Hampshire. Salem and Hollis, New Hampshire. Secure communications network for the electric grid. I'm sure you're interested in that, Steve. God knows we need a secure grid.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. Grid On from Israel, controlling power quality in electric grids. Ice Code from West Lebanon, New Hampshire. Wind turbine blade anti-icing and de-icing. Who would have thought of that? But I guess it's an issue. Ice can really make a big difference in the efficiency. And from Kiryat Israel, inflatable wind turbines. I love that. GE says passion and innovation will power the new grid. And you can find out more about the $200 million and the winners at ecoimagination.com/challenge. And we do thank General Electric for supporting Security Now and our Green Tech Show. We wouldn't be doing a Green Tech Show unless GE said, hey, let's cover the technology of green. And we've been having so much fun. Dr. Kiki, Becky Worley, Green Tech Today. If you want to find out more about that, go to iTunes or twit.tv/GTT. They're beautiful episodes they're doing. And just fascinating stuff. We just did the Chevy Volt on green, like cars, green power generation. I think Becky's got one in Scotland. I mean, it's really cool. ecoimagination.com/challenge. Thank you, General Electric, for what you're doing to support a new smart green grid. All right, so a little sci-fi.
A little sci-fi. So I read science fiction when I'm on my stair climber, which I do most days for about 66 minutes a day. I works up a good sweat and get my heart rate up and
why
so forth.
66 minutes?
It just sort of evolved that way.
It's interesting.
I was in an hour, and I looked at the calories I was burning, and I was like 643.
You wanted to get to 700?
And I thought, yeah, I'll go to 700. So, and I think I hit 700 by about 64 and a half minutes. And then I thought, well, 66 is, you know, a prettier number like than it. 64 and a half. Like so that's I just awesome. Kept rounding up. You know, one parameter or the next until I ended up at 66, and that takes me on the high side of 700 calories.
That's so awesome. That's great.
I just sort of stay there. So consequently, I'm needing a source of something to read, and I went looking for some more stuff. So I want I'm constantly getting feedback from listeners saying, "Hey, Steve, what's happening in the world of sci-fi?" So as it happens, still. The very best things that I have found are what we've talked about before. If listeners are not familiar with Peter Hamilton, he's at the top of my list.
Me too. And you introduced me to him, and I love him.
Oh, Fallen Dragon. Mm-hmm. If to get in an introduction, it's a standalone volume. He writes. He's very wordy, but so these books are long.
But they're all good words.
Yes, they are. And he paints such a rich environment that I mean, I still see all of these worlds that he has created for me. So Fallen Dragon is a perfect introduction. Then my second favorite series is just a two-volume series, is Pandora's Star, followed by Judas Unchained, which is the sequel to Pandora's Star, which is just, I've read Fallen Dragon, I think, three times. I've read both Pandora Star and Judas Unchained twice because they're, you know, these are things you can reread. They're just spectacular pieces of work. And then my second favorite, we've also spoken of before, and that's Michael McCollum's books. He has a website, sci-fi-az.com. SCIFI-AZ.com, Michael McCollum. He also writes multi-volume series, which I very much enjoy. Because again, if I read one book, it's like, okay, well, that's gone. It's annoying if the series isn't finished. And then you're like stuck waiting, which happens to me from time to time. But his Antares trilogy, Antares Dawn, Antares Passage, and Antares Victory is just fantastic. I read them all twice, and I'm just sort of waiting now for it to be long enough for me to reread them. And then the Gibraltar trilogy I've mentioned, Gibraltar Earth, sun, and stars is fantastic. And in the case of stars, I read it before it was published because just to be his proofreader. So that came out, and I reread the prior two in order to get ready for the third one to be done. So that's great. And he has also has many individual novels. But new stuff that I haven't talked about before, I made a posting to the Sci-Fi News Group at GRC, and I said, hey, guys, you know, I'm looking for more to read. I need, like, you know, kind of space opera stuff. What do you got? And someone mentioned what was called the Lost Fleet series. It's written by a guy named John G. Hemery, but he writes under the pen name Jack Campbell, C-A-M-P-B-E-L-L. And this is a series of six books called the Lost Fleet series: Dauntless, Fearless, Courageous, Valiant, Relentless, and Victorious. And I had never read anything like them before, and they were really effective in filling time. I can't say that they were fantastic science fiction, but you know, I needed something to do on the stair climber. But I could also recommend them.
There are audiobooks of this as well.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's on Audible.
Great. And this gives nothing away. I won't do any spoilers here, because in the first few pages, we're reviving a survivor of the beginning of a war from 100 years before. So we're bringing him out of cryosleep. And what's happened is there's been this war that's been going on for 100 years, space, you know, between two chunks of human civilization that are really upset with each other. Because so many casualties and people have been promoted so quickly, the people in the current fleet that sort of whose side we're on have sort of lost the art of space combat. And so we revive this guy from 100 years before who says, wait a minute, this is the way you're fighting? And he organizes space combat in a really compelling and convincing fashion. So, you know, we don't have warp drive. We have, you know, wormholes you can jump between star systems with. But the laws of physics and the speed of light play into this intimately, and the author sets up some really interesting problems and solutions that involve configurations of fleets of ships that are basically have conventional weapons and, you know, some beams and missiles and interesting weapons. But things are constrained enough that you're working within a domain that, you know, a fictional domain with real limitations, which makes it really interesting. And I found myself, you know, being sucked along in this. So if you're looking, if you've run out of stuff to read, give the first one or to listen to, give the first one a try. And I'll be surprised if you don't get hooked and end up with all six of them, because
sounds like Horatio Hornblower in the 25th century or something like that.
I think actually I've heard exactly that analogy being made. But
I love those kinds of seafaring novels. So
yeah, there's interesting there's a lot of politics because he ends up being, because he's 100 years ago, he ends up being the most senior officer. So he ends up commanding the fleet. But then there's lots of people who, of course, don't like that. And then there's some political interplay. And, you know, we got a little romance stuff going on. But mostly, you know, really, I mean, are obviously contrived because it's fiction. But, you know, satisfying space battles. And I've never read anything of this scope where you've got really interesting space battle scenarios with interesting puzzles and limitations. So I wouldn't be surprised if you read the first one and then didn't get hooked.
Sounds cool.
So I did all of those. Then I said, okay, what next? Then I ran across something called Helfort's War, L-H-E-L-F-O-R-T.
Helfort's you like these big, long series, don't you?
War.
You don't want just one book. You don't want just two books.
Well, and here was one where I ran out before the fourth book. This is a series of four, and it's sort of the classic newly minted graduate from Starfleet. I mean, it's not set in the Star Trek environment, but we do have, you know, like the academy. He's graduating from the academy, and we follow his career through four books. And I ran out at the end of the book three, and book four just was published on the 23rd of November. So it's available for Kindle, which is where I'm reading this stuff, and I haven't yet started it because I'm just finishing the fourth book in another series of six, which is Gregory Benford's Galactic Center series. So the Helfort's War books I really liked also. Again, I recommend them. They're, again, I mean, top of the list is Peter Hamilton and Michael McCollum. I don't think I would read these other ones a second time, where I have read the earlier ones a second time. Of course, not that much time has gone by, but still, I feel like I'm sort of done with those. But really, they were diverting and interesting, you know, and I think stand very well. And then Gregory Benford actually is a UCI physics professor.
I like that. I like yes. Hard science.
Yeah, it's very, this is, his is the so-called Galactic Center series. I've just finished Tides of Light, which is the fourth in the series of six. And here we sort of, we've got the humans versus the machines is like sort of the overall scenario there. And I loved back in the day the Fred Saberhagen's Berserker series.
I haven't read those either.
Oh, those are really good, Leo. You know, berserkers being machines left over from some dim, you know, unknown alien race in the past that are out to kill off all biological life. Mm. And really interesting sci-fi that I, you know, that's old. It's been around for forever. But now we've got the so-called mechs, M-E-C-H, the mechs versus the humans. And this is a huge scope, like, you know, tens of thousands of years of history, but really interesting new ideas that I've never read before, and also, you know, substantial works. So I'm liking those as well. So The Lost Fleet, Helfort's War, and Gregory Benford's Galactic Center series.
I'm amazed you have time to read all this stuff.
I spent a lot of time on the stair climber.
I guess so. Yeah, well, that's one of the advantages of being fit. You have more time to read.
Exactly.
Hey, we're going to take a little break. We have questions, good ones, from people who want to talk about Chinese redirection of traffic, peer-to-peer sharing, web fingerprinting. Before we do all that, I want to briefly mention our friends at Citrix, who do a great product for people, a lot of the people who listen to this show, who are in the IT and the software support business. It's Go to Assist Express. Have you tried it yet? It is fantastic because it really solves a problem the people who solve problems have, which is telephone support. What a nightmare that is. You've done it. We all have done it. It takes so long to figure out what's going on because you have to let the user be your eyes and ears. And that's often difficult to do if they're not, let's say, expert. Also, you know, your client may not be able to keep up with you as you walk him or her through the fix. You're going to have a long call, a lot of dead air, a lot of sitting there, a lot of frustration for both of you. You know, of course, you could drive to the person's home or office, and I know many of you will, just to avoid that frustration. But wouldn't it be cool if you could just get in their machine and fix it yourself? And that's what GoToAssist Express does. It's the easiest way to view and control another computer remotely. Very affordable. You'll see and solve the problem without being there in person, and you can do it fast. But best of all, it's remote access designed for support. So you can do 8 sessions at once. You can do unattended sessions. Very easy for your supportee. They don't have to have anything installed ahead of time. You just send them a link, and while you're on the phone, 30 seconds later, you're in. You can get an assay of what software is running, what operating system. Start your session just with one click of the mouse. I want you to try it. free for the next 30 days. 128-bit SSL encrypted, so you can use it anywhere. Free customer service for you 24/7. Just go to GoToAssist.com/security for a 30-day trial. 30 days of unlimited use. They have day passes and month passes. For the pro, you know, month to month, for people like me who do support once in a while, a day pass is great. But try it free for 30 days. GoToAssist.com/security. We thank Citrix for their support of security. Now, are you ready, Steve? Questions for you.
Yes, indeed. And I just will mention that you're right about the book series. I look for the series because I'm wanting to get engaged and have a lot to read. So it is a reason that I'm choosing those deliberately. When I see it's like book six, I go, okay, good. I'll go find number one and move through them.
No, I know what you mean because I like to get immersed. And it's kind of, you know, once you get immersed, sometimes if you get immersed in a world and it's over, it's like, well, golly.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I could, if Peter Hamilton kept writing, I just wish he would keep going, you know, with his various universes.
Well, what was it? It was the Judas Unchained went on a little long, I thought.
Yeah, and I had never got into the Dreaming Void. I think that's his next one. Because I was just sort of, it sounded a little, I mean, I really do like hard sci-fi.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want fantasy stuff and people dreaming about something. I sort of read the synopsis. I thought, I don't think so.
Yeah, no, I like the hardcore stuff.
And right. when he had who was it? Al Capone coming back to life.
Yeah.
It's like, no.
Yeah. Fallen Dragon, that's the one.
Oh, it's a great first book. Yeah.
Question one, an anonymous listener raises a good and disturbing point, Stephen Leo, regarding the Chinese redirection of traffic. You forgot to mention that SSL would not have prevented snooping in the latest traffic redirection incident. China controls root certificates that are installed in our systems. We've mentioned that before, including the Hong Kong Post Office, which enables them to do transparent SSL man in the middle. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So it is the case that I do not think this was deliberate because many mistakes have been made with BGP, the Border Gateway Protocol, in the past.
Yes.
So it's much more likely that it was a misconfiguration in the router tables that inherently propagate themselves to the routers that they're connected to, which then propagate those to the routers they're connected to, and so forth. So this kind of thing can ripple through the internet and has many times before.
Yes.
Yet, it is also the case that this protocol is not secure. And had this been deliberate, then traffic would have been routed. And there's absolutely nothing preventing them from doing on-the-fly certificate synthesis, signing the certificates with their with the private keys of the of the certificate authorities that are installed in all of our browsers. So this anonymous listener is exactly right that, I mean, it is the case that SSL would not protect us. And in fact, what that means is we would be saying www.amazon.com, be looking at what appeared to be a valid certificate and not knowing that the traffic had been redirected through someone who had control of a certificate authority that had signed this certificate that was synthesized on the fly, you know, because they knew we were connected to Amazon. So,
not good. Not good.
Not good.
Question two, another anonymous listener had a thought about defeating form style man in the middle eavesdropping. Stephen Leo, would it be possible to derive a simple protocol using certain parameters known by both the browser and the server, but I guess no one else, that would deter some systems like form, but not unduly impede security services? I was thinking perhaps the server would know, say, the connection IP address or some header, and the browser would know both the IP address of the server and the requested URL. XOR them should be fast and transient enough. John Doe, what do you think?
Well, no.
Maybe you better explain it to me.
Yeah.
I don't know what he's proposing here.
Well, so what he's saying is, isn't there something that, you know, some simple way of preventing form, which is essentially a ISP sanctioned man in the middle and eavesdropping entity. Form is the thing which is installing its own cookies on other people's domains so that it can track us and profile us, essentially. So he's saying, you know, if we established a secure connection between browser and server, then the man in the middle aspect and the eavesdropping aspect could be thwarted. The problem with doing that is, and exactly as you said, Leo, is that the man in the middle would have to be excluded from information that only the browser and the server knew. The man in the middle could see the IPs at each end, could see the headers that were being exchanged. So
now you're talking encryption.
Well,
public key encryption or something like that.
You need both encryption and you need authentication. And right. We've talked about how if you don't have authentication, if you can't authenticate, for example, the server at the server end, then anybody, by definition, anybody right. could impersonate the server and become a man in the middle. And the only way to get authentication is for there to be some sort of secret which the authenticating party is able to prove they have. And the only way to do that in an open public system is to use a public key where the authenticating party is able to prove they own the matching private key to the public key which you and everybody else have. So unfortunately, our listener is, you know, trying to come up with like a simpler solution, something less heavyweight, easier, faster, lighter weight, you know, XOR. Well, of course, XOR is an extremely weak. It's not even crypto. I can't call it crypto because it would be trivial to even without doing anything but looking at the traffic that has been XOR'd, you could easily crack that if you were XORing against a fixed pattern. If you were XORing against a pseudo random stream like the RC4 crypto does, then all of the things being secure, this could potentially be secure too. But the problem is there isn't a way to make it simpler. If you make it simpler, you lose authentication. And if you lose that, you've got nothing. So unfortunately, we have made it exactly as simple as possible, which is unfortunately not very.
Question three, Rick Shepard, Reno, Nevada, wonders about the .p2p TLD, top-level domain. Steve, I'd like to hear your thoughts on the proposed P2P top-level domain. It's supposed to be ICANN independent, and this is relevant to what's going on right now with ICANN being used by the Department of Homeland Security to take down torrent servers. It would allow we, the people, he says, to bypass traditional DNS and thereby remove the power from ICE or whomever may wish to take down domain names. He refers to a website, .p2p.org. It's a wiki for more information on that one.
So this is interesting. What is being proposed is a sort of a secondary or alternative DNS, which would be decentralized, and whereas our existing DNS is based on a hierarchy starting at the top with, you know, root servers, the famous 13 root servers that then point to the com and the org and the net and then all of the second level domain and so forth, there's this proposal to create a .p2p sort of, you know, like .com, .net, .org, .edu, and so forth. The problem is it's being led by the Pirate Bay guy, Peter Sund, S-U-N-D-E, who was just convicted recently along with the two other Pirate Bay people, of being complicit in the theft of copyrighted material. they're appealing this this judgment that did just recently come down against them. The prison term was reduced to 8 months, yet the fine was increased to, I think it was $8.8 million, although it was denominated in their currency. So, you know, in principle, you know, I'm troubled, as you are, Leo, by the idea that our government, the U.S. government, and presumably other governments, could get it into their head that removing domains from the internet is, wow, gee, that was easy. You know, I mean, in the same way that we've got this problem with earmarks in our legislation, where some legislator, you know, tag something into legislation that's going by and it gets through, you can imagine someone saying, yeah, you know, could you remove this domain for me as a favor? Because, you know, they're our competition, and it gets sort of slid into some other package of domains being removed. I mean, it feels like a slippery slope. The problem I have is that I hate the idea of this being used only for piracy and theft of copyrighted material, which is really the way this seems like it's being set up. I'm troubled by the idea that domains can get removed. So what this is, the idea is, it would be like BitTorrent, and in fact, they're proposing that it would actually use the decentralized BitTorrent hashing.
Oh, that's interesting.
Protocol.
Because you have a problem if you're not in the main directory servers. How do you get visible?
Right. And so the idea is that people who wanted access to this, it's probably going to end up being a hierarchy of pirate domains, which, if nothing else, would live sort of off the grid or off the hierarchy. You would run a client on your computer, which would link up in BitTorrent style to a mesh of other clients and share all of this .p2p top-level domain, essentially share the hierarchy of DNS. The client living on your computer would filter your outgoing DNS queries. If the domains going out were not .p2p, that is, didn't have that on the far right side, it would let it go through. And the regular public DNS hierarchy would resolve the IP address. If, however, anything, you know, you put into your web browser, you know, piratesrus.p2p, then the client running on your machine would see that, intercept it, and then use this sort of this decentralized, floating in the cloud, interlinked peer-to-peer DNS alternative for its IP resolution. And you'd get the IP of that domain, and, you know, it would be, from a user standpoint, rather transparent. So it's clever, it can work, and it is going to happen. It's pretty much, I mean, there's enough inertia behind this already that I think, you know, and it's an interesting enough idea that people who are interested think, hey, that's kind of cool. I mean, if I would think it was kind of cool, except that I'm afraid it's only going to be used by the dark forces, you know, and not by people who are sort of more honestly wishing to avoid government control. But I'm sure it'll be used for that too. So
I think, you know, at some point we may need a dark net.
You know, the way things are going, it does seem like it. I mean, I'm finding myself, as I was talking about, innocently exchanging some email about the what's going on in airports with body scanning, and even talking about nuclear and Iran and Stuxnet, I'm finding myself a little self-conscious about the fact that I'm probably now I'm using words that are tripping filters somewhere, and my email is being observed by our government. And it's a little creepy to think that that's going on. I hope they understand I'm one of the good guys. But it's, you know, it's unfortunate that this is changing. And you know, Leo, you can almost sort of feel, unfortunately, this happening, you know, as the internet matures. You know, it's like, well, they're not happy about the taxes they're losing for internet sales. They're not happy about what happened with WikiLeaks and these cables getting out. You know, the government wants control. Yep. And of course, now we have the FBI not happy about encryption. And, you know, it's, you know, poked me right in my own backyard.
I think the forces of reaction, the reactionaries, are actually gaining power. And the good news is the people who know how to use technology can be the freedom fighters. I think it's the 21st century freedom fighters are the hackers of the world, and I say that in the best sense of the word, who know how to use technology. And I think ultimately we might have to create a dark net. But the good news is, we can.
we
know
true.
How.
There, I mean, it is true, and the bad news is, I mean, when I look at for example, my own intention of doing CryptoLink, you know, I want to empower people to have secure private communications. I'm not going to do it if the law requires that I put a back door into the product such that
right.
I'm not able to offer them secure private communications.
Right.
So, and what's so sad about this is math is what this is based on. Math exists already. I mean, the technology to do this exists. OpenVPN is a perfectly fine, functional VPN system. It's, you know, way clunky, and I can make something far better, but the bad guys will use that if right. they want something that cannot be eavesdropped on. I mean, it already exists. It's you know, the horses have left the barn. So,
yeah. So
I don't know what my position is on something like a distributed, control-free network. It is certainly possible to do, just like, you know, secure crypto is possible to do.
I would say now's the time for all good men to learn a little programming and network configuration.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I actually said this about 8 years ago. I did an interview for a movie about Adrian Lama about hacking. Mm-hmm. And I said, I think hackers are the freedom fighters of the 21st century. I think instead of the right to bear arms, we need a new Second Amendment that includes the right to bear technology. Mark Jones, go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say, and I hate the idea. I hate the idea that CryptoLink might be used for a purpose that was really foul. I mean, really evil. But, you know, that's the nature of, that's the nature of technology. It, in the same way that a nuclear bomb can be used for something that is really wrong,
yeah.
really evil. I mean, it's not the atom's fault that it contains a lot of energy.
I think you have to consider what the alternative is. Yes, it's bad, but the alternative is worse.
Yeah.
Yes, it's potentially bad, but the alternative is far worse. Mark Jones, you know, it's basically a world controlled by those who would assert their power.
And unfortunately, we see that they choose to.
And they're glad to.
Yes.
Mark Jones in Midland, Michigan, wonders about web fingerprinting and fonts. You're turning me into a libertarian. We're both, you know, it's funny, Steve and I are both staunch liberals, but I have a feeling we're becoming more libertarian as the government becomes more reactionary. Mark Jones in Midland, Michigan, wonders about a web fingerprinting and fonts. Steve, let me thank you for the wonderful podcast. It's been my favorite and a must listen for several years now. You and Leo are the best. Today's Wall Street Journal front page contains another article in their ongoing series on web privacy. This one addresses, which we have decried, I might add. This one addresses the technology of Blue Kava for web fingerprinting. The technology is clearly not unique to Blue Kava. It is the web fingerprinting technology you described some time ago that pulls many different attributes of a particular system. A unique pattern that identifies a system emerges when these attributes are viewed as a set. I don't remember what episode we talked about that in, but it's just a few episodes ago, worth listening to. It wasn't the Ever Cookie. It was
unlike the other episodes.
They're all great. Well, you know, it's really interesting because this show is in many ways on the cutting edge of what's going on here.
Yeah.
It's not just security and privacy, it's everything. As a loyal Security Now listener, I was surprised to actually learn something from the mass media about security. He's talking about the journal article, not us.
Right.
The article called to my attention that one of the means the fingerprinting uses is to interrogate fonts on the system. I think you mentioned this, actually.
It's enumeration.
Right. Yep. Several years ago, I converted my handwriting into a font. I gave the resulting font the fairly obvious name of my name. My name's fairly generic, but I'm betting it might be. I might be the only person to have a font with my name. I bet you're right. I never thought this might be a beacon for tracking me on the web. And by itself, it might, even if your name is John Smith, by itself it might not be. But then if there's a universe of 12 John Smiths who have fonts named John Smith, you're the only one with this version of Flash, this version of a browser, this this particular screen resolution. By the time they add them all up, we're all one of a kind. Prompts a couple of questions. How many ways can the fonts in your system be interrogated by a website you visit? Can all of the Blue Kava methods be blocked by the use of NoScript? Are there other means to block the font list from prying eyes? I think that's it.
How many ways can the fonts on your system be interrogated by a website you visit?
Is it JavaScript that does that? That says, JavaScript's activated by the visiting site and says, because the sites can typically query your computer about its capabilities.
Yes. Now, there's some of the information is just in the browser headers. But, for example, the reason I chose this question was not so that I could tell him that there were three ways that fonts could be queried. Because, I mean, who knows how many?
Right.
I mean, it's just I thought this was a great question. Unfortunately, Blue Kava is somewhere. I mean, I'm looking over my shoulder now because they're in Irvine. And
is it a company?
Yeah, it's a company. The Wall Street Journal's article is just horrifying. Oh, I mean, it is chilling. This guy,
this is legal, by the way. It's completely legal.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's one of those things where you read the article and it just sends shivers up the spine of anyone who's concerned about their privacy, because he's boasting how many different fingerprints he's accumulated and how unique they are, and just in the news, I didn't pull this out for the podcast, but a Department of Transportation in Florida was just found guilty of selling tens of millions of drivers' personal information to a internet-based marketing company. So it's a government agency.
How dare they?
I know. Jesus. Including Social Security numbers, which they have. Yes.
What state was that? Arkansas?
It was in Orlando.
Orlando, Florida.
Yeah. I think if you put in Orlando, Florida, I pulled it up by putting the name of the marketing company. But I was like, oh, goodness. So now we have the government, profiting from selling our personal information to internet-based marketing companies. So, I mean, they'll get their hands slapped hard, and it's, wrong they did it. But the information's loose now. It's gone. You can't get it back.
I'd be incensed.
So I wanted to reiterate that, yes, the number one thing that's protecting you is blocking scripting. That is no script, because all of this stuff, font enumeration and the deeper lock on to you technology involves scripting. So it is, remember that scripting, I mean, it's a mixed blessing. Yes, more and more sites need it. I know that a huge percentage of our listeners are running no script, and yes, it's annoying. It gets in your way to be blocking scripting by default. I'll go to sites that I haven't visited before, and something kind of doesn't seem right. It happened this morning when I was going to some sites looking around at things. It's like, okay, this page doesn't seem correct, or like I'll fill in the state that I'm in, and then the fields on a form below didn't populate, and I go, oh. And so I turn on scripting, and now the site comes alive, and the form works the way it's supposed to. Well, so it isn't transparent, but given that there's so much power in scripting, you want it to be only used on your behalf for your benefit and not against you. And unfortunately, companies like this that are founding themselves on what scripting can do are taking advantage of that. So scripting is necessary for enumerating fonts. You can't do it without it. But even without scripting, browsers give away a lot in their headers, as we've seen. I think it was the EFF that did their, the name's not coming to me now, Panopticlick, that we talked about again several months ago. Panopticlick, as I remember, was just doing passive examination of what the browser was relinquishing without scripting, and it was comprehensive. So, you know, even just looking at like the version numbers of all the things that we've got installed on our computer tend to make it unique, and the resolution of our screens and the you know, obvious information that is getting away. So somebody who really is concerned about this does need to do something like we've talked about, which is, you know, boot a browser-enabled OS from a CD, or use a virtual machine, use a VM, and, you know, to use a generic browser that you haven't customized much, and do your surfing that way, so that and maybe change it from time to time, so that you don't have a static fingerprint. I mean, I don't mean to overhype the issue of tracking and fingerprinting. I know that some people just, they don't care. But increasingly, when people realize that this is going on behind their back, if nothing else, they ought to understand what they can do to prevent it if they do care. And sadly, scripting is the means for this happening, and disabling it conditionally is the way to get around it.
Mm. I don't like it.
No.
When smart techies are on the wrong side of the equation.
Yeah, it's interesting. This guy who found the Blue Calva, he apparently years ago started off because he wanted to protect downloadable music software. And so he came up with a way of locking music software to a machine by looking for like the fingerprint of the machine, so that you would it would only run in the machine with that fingerprint, and people could use it freely before, try it out in a demo before purchasing it. And then he wouldn't have to worry about it getting loose. And then he realized, hey, there's a lot here that I can lock onto that makes this unique. And it's like, and now, of course, he's switched over to the dark side and going to make money by tracking and profiling and building up this big database of fingerprints.
Oh, he's so proud of it, too. If you visit the website, it's like, I've got a patent and look what I can do. And blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Boo hiss. Question five. Edward Ted Doyle in Columbia, Missouri, wonders about the allocation of IP addresses for efficient routing. Steve, I've been listening since episode one, my favorite podcast. I've been reading a wonderful free book about TCP/IP, and neither your past podcasts introducing basic internet concepts nor the first 500 pages of the book have addressed so far the notion of IP address allocation for efficient routing. There are about 64 times 256 or something like 16,000 class B addresses. That is IPv4 with the first number of the IP address starting 128 through 191. If these addresses are assigned to organizations in a disorganized fashion, the following situation could occur. I don't know if I want to read all this. basically, 140.65.star goes to a company in Australia, then 66 to Poland, 67 to Edmonton. You get the idea. They're all, you know, just geographically random. There must be some order to the way addresses are assigned. He's thinking like zip codes, where you know, it narrows it down geographically.
And zip codes is a great example, as a matter of fact, Leo. Yeah.
For instance, if the IP block with 140 through 147 in the first byte were assigned to Europe, and then Europe could, say, take 140 and assign it to England, 141 to France, and so on. I don't think it was anywhere near this organized, of course. Thus, the router in St. Louis, using one router table entry, could examine the first number in the IP address, see something between 140 and 147, and know the packet needs to be routed eastward toward Europe. Is this how IP addresses are assigned and routed? If not, could you describe how IP addresses are allocated to make routing feasible? We need John Postel on. he was the guy who made this all up way back in the way back when. The late John Postel at USC. Yeah, I know that most routers use classless interdomain routing, or CIDR, obsoleting the old class A, B, and C systems. The book I'm reading, by the way, is The TCP/IP Guide by Charles Kozirok. The full 1,600-page text is available. I love this. At tcipguide.com. So far, I'm only about a third of the way in. The next 100 to 200 pages, I'll reach the chapters on routing protocols. I will continue reading the book and listening to your podcast for the answer to this question. Best regards, Ted Doyle, Columbia, Mizzou.
Okay, so there's a cool URL you need to put into a browser, and our listeners should, if they're listening, bgp.potaroo.net.
bgp.potaroo.net.
Yeah,
oh, look at this. This is interesting. I don't know what it is.
Well, that's the growth of the BGP router table over time.
So this is the table that all border gateway routers use to figure out where goes what.
It's the size of the table. Currently, 336,807 entries.
How big is it?
Well,
is it 100K, a megabyte, a gigabyte?
No. The
can't be very big.
These routers, well, the good news is an IPv4 address is 4 bytes, and a mask is 4 bytes.
Right.
So all of these, they do compress, and they are very dense, but there are a lot of them. So to wind back a little bit and answer Edward Ted Doyle's question is, unfortunately, had we to do it again, we would do it differently.
Yeah.
But, when has that not been the case?
Nobody thought it would be this way.
No one thought it was going to even work, Leo.
I don't know who is Potaroo, but this is a really interesting site.
Yeah, it's a great site with a lot of interesting statistics. So to some degree, this does work. For example, level 3 has the whole 4-dot network. So to the degree that level 3 controls the routing within their network, there doesn't have to be individual entries in the global BGP tables for every network within level 3. For example, my little 16 IPs at level 3, they certainly aren't represented uniquely in some router table entry in Bulgaria. Instead, anything that begins with 4 goes in the direction of level 3. And that's the last of it. So it absolutely is the case that there, as we know, there is a hierarchical allocation of IP space that where, 4-dot is level 3, and I think HP has 15 and 16, or they have two consecutive ones that are class A networks. And so everything beginning with 15 and 16 goes towards HP. Now, the problem is HP is widely distributed geographically, so their IPs are probably global, and there will be many more entries for things beginning with 15 and 16 than, for example, level 3 that might be more regional. But it's certainly the case that there is some regionality to routing. And so when a large ISP is regional and giving their various customers chunks of address space, well, everything first goes to the ISP and is routed monotonically to the ISP, then the ISP's routers break it up and send it to the appropriate customers within those networks. So, if we could renumber the internet, we could radically simplify things.
Interesting.
But we can't renumber the internet. No, I mean, no one wants to have chunks of their IPs just, ripped away and changed. So we're sort of stuck with this. it's not clear that it's going to get any better either. I mean, as you know, we can see the growth is it's not exponential, but it's certainly little more than linear over time. And here we're saying we need, you know, that 4 billion IPs is no longer 4.3 billion IPs is no longer enough. So we've outgrown 32 bits of IP space. You know, unfortunately, routing is going to keep being a challenge. So, yes, it would be nice if it were done somewhat more sanely. But at this point, it's the cat's out of the bag.
Too late.
Yep.
Dennis Keefe, Panama City, wonders about securely using LastPass on a work PC. Steve, the following is a post from my blog. What do you think? If you love LastPass but are not exactly comfortable about having it installed in your work PC, you might like this solution. Today I tried this approach. First, I used TrueCrypt to create an encrypted volume on the hard drive. Most offices won't let you do that, by the way. Many offices won't. Mine will. Next, I went to portableapps.com, and instead of downloading the software to your USB drive as usual, I installed it into the encrypted volume. Now, the only way to access Firefox in my LastPass vault is by mounting that TrueCrypt volume. Of course, I need the pass to do it. If you still need Firefox installed for others in your office, just install a stripped-down version for others to use. It doesn't include any personal info. And you're saved. Keep up the great work. Dennis Keefe, thecommongeek.com, Panama City, Florida. That's actually a very clever idea.
It is clever. There's one thing I would add to it. First of all, what Portable Apps does is kind of neat. They have they've got portableized versions of existing apps like Firefox, for example, that are specifically well behaved in not using things like the registry. So, for example, Firefox will create a traditional an initialization style file, where all of the things that it would normally be storing in the registry, all of its configuration information, it will store locally instead. So these are deliberately portableized versions of otherwise non-portable, or maybe you could say unclean from a standpoint of leaving fingerprints or footprints behind, applications. So the one thing I would add is that the LastPass people themselves have done a portable LastPass. So instead of using the normal LastPass, use LastPass Portable, which is freely available and downloadable. And then you've really got the best of both worlds. You've got Firefox, which is itself not going to dirty up the computer, leaving anything behind, and LastPass, which you can be absolutely sure isn't going to do that either. The problem with running non-portable LastPass in Firefox is that although Firefox may be behaving itself, you don't know that the plugins you're running are going to behave themselves, and they certainly could reach out and go put stuff in the registry, which you're saying, you know, you explicitly don't want to have happen. So use the portable version of LastPass, and then you're good to go.
Perfect. Question 7, Ralph in California. He wonders about alternatives for Macintosh for reading PDFs. In episode 276, Testing DNS Spoofability, you encouraged listeners to find an alternative to Adobe Reader. And I think we mentioned Foxit. I use Foxit Phantom, which I love on Windows. What are the best-of-breed PDF readers for the Mac?
And Leo, this is a question for you.
You don't need one.
That's what I thought you were going to say.
Because, in fact, that's really what's kind of killed the whole market for PDF readers for the Mac. Apple distributes Preview with Macintosh, which reads PDFs. If you want to annotate PDFs, there's a free open source program called Formulate Pro. It's what I use. It lets you take a PDF and annotate it. Whenever I get documents that I need to sign, I just open them in Formulate, paste my signature on them. It's probably illegal. Save them out, and I've got a PDF with a signature on it. So you don't need it. Preview works great.
You know, Apple must have had a deal with Adobe a long time ago because, of course, the original Apple LaserWriter that was the first laser printer was using PostScript as its language.
Right.
And we know that that's the basis for, you know, all of this PDF technology and so forth that Adobe has. So I would imagine some sort of license agreement was created back in the dim early days of, you know, personal computing, which Apple has been able to cruise on ever since.
The next corporation used something called Display PostScript for its display layer.
The entire system was PostScript-based.
Yep. And it's my understanding, you know, I've asked this question because I'm not clear. Did they license this? PostScript is open. And so I think...
So the specification is formally open.
Exactly.
Ah.
So I don't believe that Apple actually licenses the ability to read and write PDFs.
They don't need to.
Or to use Display PostScript. I think they wrote their own clean code based on an open standard.
That would explain why Adobe's not running around suing everybody, because
right.
They can't.
Whoops.
Yeah.
I'm sure they would love to. Rick in Canada gives us our last question, which happens to be the Firefox add-on tip of the week. Put Echo in there later, okay? Stephen Leo, I found a great Firefox add-on. It's SSL Personas, all one word, SSLPersonas. What it does is change the Firefox persona on the fly. I guess that's kind of like its profile, right?
Well, it's the way the whole UI looks, like coloration and so forth.
Oh, everything, okay. So that you know you're on an SSL site. When you're on an SSL site, it rewrites the look of the whole browser.
Yes.
Instead of needing to look for a little lock or the S on the HTTP on the address bar or the green address bar, it changes everything. Check it out. Listener since number one and a happy owner of SpinRite, Rick in Canada. Did you try it?
I did not try it, but I'm going to. I didn't because I've got so many tabs open that restarting Firefox is a major event.
I don't even want to restart Firefox, Steve.
But I looked at the reviews. It looks really neat, so I wanted to recommend it. I mean, you might call this in your face opposed to SSL personas because, you know, in the examples, it turns the whole thing green or the whole thing blue. It's able to essentially verify the validity of the certificate. So it's not just are you using SSL, but are you using a SSL with a completely valid certificate? In which case, it really makes it obvious, which I think is nice. I like the idea that the UI is going to be really showing me the security of the page that I'm on. So I can't wait to restart Firefox after the podcast and give it a shot. But I wanted to share with our listeners because I think that's a great add-on.
Yeah, and you know, you could always do, it doesn't have to be green. I mean, you could do something really silly. you could say safe. I like he's put locks and certificates and all sorts of stuff on it. That'd be a great thing to do for less sophisticated family members.
Yes.
Say, Mom, unless you see this, you know, you ain't got it.
Right.
I think that's good. Yeah. He has a bunch of different, I guess, templates that you can use. No Chrome version that I know of, but that would be a nice little Chrome extension if anybody wants to write one.
Speaking of Chrome, there is a portable Chrome go with. Portable Chrome and portable LastPass for Chrome.
Right.
So people who are Chrome users, as I know you are, Leo, can do the same portability trick with LastPass using the portable LastPass for Chrome in addition to the portable LastPass for Firefox.
LastPass did everything right.
Oh, they really did. And I will take this opportunity again to say I'm loving it.
I use it everywhere.
I mean, I really am. I can't imagine now life without it.
Yeah, so, no kidding. Just done right.
And it's free.
Steve Gibson is at grc.com. That's free. Also, lots of freebies. Lots of great free utilities. That DNS spoofability thing that we talked about. The DNS benchmark thing that we talked about. There's all sorts of stuff. Shields up. Why are you laughing? What do you call it?
The spoofability thing. The spoofability, spoofability test.
Tester, yeah. There's so much free stuff there. I like Wismo. You know, that still works on Windows 7. It's great. Yep. It's like 12K of assembly code. It's tiny. And, of course, don't forget the bread and butter, which is SpinRite, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility, a must-have if you've got a hard drive.
I did run across three really fun testimonials just this morning when I was reading the email bag. So I'm saving those. I'm saving one of those for next week and for weeks to come. So
thank you for sending them.
Yeah. Yes, it does.
Yeah, you're saving hard drives right and left. You can also find this podcast there, including 16 kilobit versions, which are only available from Steve because he actually makes them. And he also gets the transcripts done by Elaine. So that's what you'll find there, all the show notes. We also have it, of course. It's on iTunes and the Zune Marketplace and at twit.tv/SN. We record the show every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time at live.twit.tv. We invite you to tune in and join us in the chat room, irc.twit.tv. It's fun, but you can always listen after the fact. We have audio as well and video, too, by the way, so you can watch Steve. And Steve sometimes does the show with his eyes closed and his hands like this, and it's really fun. Steve, always a pleasure. I am not going to be here next week. I'm in France. Tom Merritt will fill in, I'm sure, quite capably. Have a great time next week, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Will do. Thanks, Leo. Talk to you in 2 weeks, and thanks so much.
All right, take care. Security now.